Welcome to Light of the Prophets with Yoel HaLevi. This series was recorded with John Ovandor at Truth to You Radio. For more episodes, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
G'day, wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on TruthToYou.org. That's truth number two, letteryou.org. We can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo and Prince HaLevi the Fourth.
Prince HaLevi the Fourth. Yeah, he's a permanent guest on the show, playing with his toys and making noise. He's a special guest, but he's a permanent guest because at least for the next couple of weeks, until you change your clocks in Australia, this is not his bedtime yet. Usually, we record when it's his bedtime, and
you have to change his bedtime if it clashes.
We what? Have to. Babies have schedules, okay? I have four children, and I know how it works. They have schedules.
No. I'm gonna have it. I'll get the listeners to sign a petition. so that Prince HaLevi the Fourth can remain in the program. I don't know. Maybe we'll petition Greenwich Mean Time and see if they can change something for us. He stays on the program, believe me. Hey, what's news with you, my friend? What's going on?
So what's news with me? Besides the fact I didn't sleep last night, so I'm exhausted. So yes, people, we're sacrificing my sleep to do this program. You have no idea how exhausted I am. And it was really funny because last night I came back from Jerusalem because I was looking for a birthday gift from my oldest son. Yes, he had a birthday. He's 8 years old now. It's pretty amazing. You know, I'm young and I already have an 8 year old son, which is pretty amazing. I remember when we went to the first ultrasound and the guy, it was really funny. We had this guy from Russia, wonderful doctor, ultrasound technician as well. Mm-hmm. And he goes and he starts looking at it and he says, "You want to see what gender it is?" And I go, "Yeah, you know, I don't care knowing. So he pulls it out and he says, "Okay, you see that little thing sticking there? That makes him male." And I'm like, "Yes." And my wife and I went out and bought this huge tub of ice cream, which was terrible for me because I was grossly overweight then and a lot of sugar. But we bought this big tub of ice cream and
to celebrate.
Because, listen, you know, my story, I mean, the whole deal is that, you know, I've been alone. I've been supporting myself from the age of 17 and a half, mm-hmm. and haven't really had any real family for years. I mean, it was several years until I got, you know, my parents left the country, and I was here by myself from the age of 17 and a half, run around the hills of Samaria and Judea. And then I went into the army and got engaged.
You make yourself sound like some kind of wild man running around in the hills of Samaria. What are you talking about?
I was living on a mountaintop in Samaria. There's a few houses.
You were a wild man running around the hills?
I wasn't wild. I was actually one of the most civilized guys there. No, there's all civilized people there. There's no wild people. But, you know, it's an issue, you know. You go around mountain hills and everything, and it's a different lifestyle. I mean, anyone who lives in a mountain that's not connected, you know, we're kind of far away from a village or a town or something, mm-hmm. it feels kind of wild, you know. Bathroom sometimes is a hole in the ground, you know, stuff like that.
Sure.
There's a whole discussion about, you know, there's a whole thing in the Book of Deuteronomy about having a digging instrument.
That's right.
You're out of the camp. So I remember when I was in the army, we spoke a lot about this because we had this, we had the vest and everything, and we actually mm-hmm. had a digging pick that mm-hmm. we had to dig holes to go to the bathroom for, and we had to make sure it's covered and everything.
Sure.
And it was pretty amazing to actually fulfill this commandment of the Torah that when you're in a military camp and you go out and you have to dig this hole, and yeah, every soldier had to have a pick.
Yeah,
and it was really weird. It says
you all have to go. You go outside of the camp. You dig your hole. You cover it over because the Lord your God walks in the midst of the camp and doesn't want to, you know, turn away because of some uncleanness in the camp.
Exactly. So we always it was pretty amazing because this is a secular army, but it was funny that this one out of two laws that the Torah gives about the army camp, one mm-hmm. of them was actually kept, and it was we had to do it. If you were without your pick, you can get punished. So, you know, it was pretty amazing, you know. We spoke about it many times that we're fulfilling a commandment of the Torah by doing this. So it was pretty amazing. It was pretty cool. What was amazing, you know, besides having the creation of life, a child and everything, it was me, you know, reestablishing my footing in the land of Israel. You know, up to that point, I was by myself and I got married. But unfortunately, for example, my parents weren't even at our wedding. It was a really sad case because they couldn't come into, they couldn't leave the U.S. because of the green card process. Mm-hmm. So they stayed there. So they were basically on the phone listening to the ceremony, and we made sure there's a video, and we sent them a copy of it. And I took two photographers to have as many pictures as possible. So there's loads and loads. There's like hundreds of pictures. People told me it was a pretty amazing wedding because I was still in the army. My unit was supposed to come in, and that same day they were sent to Jericho. Some of the only people who were able to come to the wedding was actually the highest ranking officer in my unit. And he and I had a reasonable, it was pretty funny. He actually had a reasonable relationship. He actually really appreciated me. But a lot of people came. It was a pretty amazing wedding, though. The guy who played the music for our wedding, we had live music, and he came in and he set everything up. And after the wedding, he walks up to me and says, "Listen, I don't know what to tell you, but this was one of the happiest weddings I've ever been at."
That's great. Isn't that great? That's so nice for him to say that.
And they played extra time for us and everything because they knew my family wasn't there. And he said, "I know what happened, but God from above sent this real feeling of joyfulness with everyone here." I'm sharing this because I need people to understand, you know, this is why flying to the U.S. is so important. So I want to thank, we did this last week, I'm doing this again. I want to thank everyone for helping out, the people who helped. And also people who support with prayer and everything. It's a big thing. A lot of changes have happened the past couple of months. A lot of personal revelation about things. A lot of interesting relationships as well. It's an interesting time I'm living in, for at least for myself privately. But we're also doing a whole bunch of stuff. You know, we're trying to create a website now. Again, she told me this before, and I'm going to say it again. I want to thank a certain student of mine, and she knows who she is, for putting a lot of effort in her expertise in creating websites and everything. We're going to launch this website very, very soon. We have the layout. We have the information. We have everything. We have videos. And we're going to upload as much as I can. I plan on doing videos now dealing with verses like I just did with Zechariah 12, verse 10. I'm going to start, you know, someone said start from Genesis 1. I said that's a lot of work. But you know what? I'm going to start producing videos like that. It takes a while. And, you know, I do apologize. It took a while for me to actually put the video up and everything. But you have to remember, I watch out for the kids. I'm actually a full-time dad, and I also work. So there's a lot going on. I do a lot of the shopping, and we don't have a car. It's very expensive to have a car here in Israel. So we actually don't have a car. So everything is backpacking and catching rides and buses and everything. It takes a while. So if I promise I'll produce something, I will do it. Just you have to hold on and give me the time to do this because I don't have anyone. I do everything by myself. Everything is done by myself. The same way you, Jono, you do all the editing and all the interview. Everything is done privately. You do it by yourself. Same thing here. So any article I produce, I don't pull these things out of my sleeve. I don't make things up. I study the book of Mishlei of Proverbs every day, and I keep a rule to myself. If I'm going to publish something, I have to make sure it's 100%. I actually made one time I made a mistake, and it was pointed out to me, and I immediately removed it because it was a mistake. It was wrong. I can't keep it there if it's wrong. But if I say I'm going to produce something, I'll do it. It's just give me some time.
Just take some time. And so what you're saying is that we are expecting to see at some stage in the future a website, a Hebrew in Israel website?
We're going to make sure it's Hebrew in Israel. I actually own the name, so
brilliant. So that's what we like to hear. But in the meantime, Hebrew in Israel Facebook page. People, he's almost up to 1,000 likes. Go and help him out. If you haven't liked Hebrew in Israel on Facebook, click him over to 1,000 likes. And one of those videos recently surfaced, and that was in regards, I think you made mention, was Zechariah 10:12, is that the one?
It's 12:10, I think.
12:10. And people can see that there. It is up, and you can watch it there on Hebrew in Israel Facebook page.
By the way, that specific video, I put research into it, and no one's actually, I haven't seen anyone try to challenge what I say there yet. And I don't think anyone will be able to do it because this is just a grammatical thing. But again, if there's anyone out there who can disprove what I said, I mean, gladly. I mean, that's the fun of being a researcher, that you rediscover things, or you make a mistake and someone proves you wrong and stuff like that. It's the fun of it. You have to treat it as fun. This is not a this is not a crusade. This is not, you know, putting your fist down on the table and saying, I know the truth. This is an issue of trying to discover the truth of the Almighty and what he tried, what he said to us. This is an attempt to understand. And
yes.
Bothers me a lot, and I've spoken about this a couple of times, what bothers me a lot is the fact that people think they're in a war with one another. You know something? That's what destroyed the Second Temple, this robbery. And seriously, put it this, I'm relatively young, but I have a lot of experience in polemics and discussions, and I live in a country where, you know, people first will tell to your face what they think. No one hides from one another. They actually tell it to your face. And a place with a lot of rivalry with the Arabs and everything, you know something? I've had my share of battles. I've had my share of wars. And trust me, it's stupid. There's no need for it. It's completely, utterly, grotesquely stupid.
Amen. I agree. Well, my friend, where are we? We're in 1 Samuel chapter 3. Is this where we're up to?
That's what I have marked in my book.
All right. It is Samuel's first prophecy, right? This is Samuel chapter 3. Shall I kick it off?
So this is actually where Samuel becomes a prophet. But what's very interesting here is that at this stage, your prophecy, first of all, prophecy is very, very rare. I mean, it emphasizes this a couple of times.
It does. It says so, yeah.
And what's also interesting, he doesn't – okay, if we go, for example, and we'll read this in a second, but if we go, for example, just Isaiah 6 or Ezekiel, the famous chariot thing actually a rabbinic tradition that says that all the prophets had a revelation of some kind, of some sort. Some say there's one place where they say that all the prophets saw the chariot of Ezekiel, but Ezekiel specifically saw the description of the chariot is in Ezekiel, because people were saying, oh, there are no prophets outside of the land of Israel. And there's a whole drama that goes on there, just, you know, Ezekiel being a prophet outside of the land of Israel and being a prophet really to the exile. God would make sure that, you know, everyone knows this is a real prophet, because they had fake prophets. Jeremiah mentions this, so they had fake prophets in outside of the land. And it was actually, some people claim there was a tradition that there's no such thing as prophecy outside of the land. I know some people won't like hearing this, but there is such an opinion, and I don't know if it's true or not true, because, for example, Nahum is from the Al-Kushi, or the Al-Kushite, which is Al-Kush, which actually seems to be outside, more to the area of Baghdad. So I don't know if to say this is true or not, but what's interesting is that Samuel is one of the big prophets. He actually is a big prophet, because he's not only just a prophet, but also a leader. And it even mentions in Jeremiah, it says, even if Samuel, Moses, and Aaron come before me, he's basically putting Moses and Aaron and Samuel at the same level.
In the same basket, yeah.
Samuel is one of these prophets. He's like an Elijah. He's like a Moses, Aaron, Elijah, Elisha combined together. He's like super prophet because... No, because he does things. First of all, he's the first one to receive absolute revelation from God. He has it looks like he has a close relationship with God, and he goes around. He brings people back to God. Now, Elijah, Moses was a leader. That's Samuel as well. Elijah, it says that God will bring him back to return the hearts of fathers to their sons and the sons to their fathers. That's Samuel as well. To go around and bring people back to Torah, and he had a circle. He went around the land, and every year he'd go back home, stay there for a short while, and then go again around the land, proclaiming God as the God of Israel. He is a major prophet as well. That's like everyone else, but he also performs these unusual miracles. He says, God, please do something, and he does it. That's very similar to Elijah as well, and Elisha. And he is in temple service part of the time. He's like Aaron. So he's like a super duper combined super prophet type of thing. There's a lot combined in his character. And he lives in the temple. And we'll see that in a second. So we're not dealing just Samuel, just a second, but we're dealing with a major character that his name echoes throughout the centuries. And he's the first one to create a line of kings. He's the first one to bring the light back to the world. Remember the rabbi who taught us, he said to us, this is where the light, this is the light at the end of the tunnel, this is the book of Samuel. Mm. So there's a lot of attention to what he does. He doesn't lose his temper. He's always very calculated. Mm-hmm. But you see the pain. He's in pain about a lot of things. He feels the pain of the nation. He feels the pain of the leadership. And he's really absorbed in being with Israel, a part of Israel. He's not, he literally puts away his personal life. He has only two sons, like Moses. But mm-hmm. he puts away his personal life and puts himself into the nation. He literally gives himself for the people. And that's a true character.
Isn't that what his mother dedicated him to be, though? I mean, she literally handed him over to the service of God. And I don't suppose that that means that when he comes of age that ends. It seems like it's a lifelong pledge.
She says Ad Olam. She makes him Ad Olam is eternally or all times. Mm. Human beings is no eternal. We all die at one point. But she basically says throughout his entire lifespan. And that's exactly what happens with him. But it starts at a very, very young age. And this is – it's interesting because the only chapter deals with his young age and being a child is only chapter 3, and it focuses on something very, very specific. But he's putting contrast – again, I mentioned this in other terms. He's putting contrast to the current leadership that's doing a horrible job in being leaders and causing a lot of damage to the name of God. And Samuel does the exact opposite. He reestablishes the name of God. I won't be surprised if he helps reestablishing the temple after the temple in Shiloh is destroyed. And he goes around and proclaims the name of God wherever he goes, which mm-hmm. is like, hey, so we're not, this is a person who all the major characters, a lot of the major characters of the Bible, including the loyalty of Moses and David, but he doesn't. There's no description of sin with him. He's kind of perfect to a certain degree.
Sure.
I can go on and on and on, but we have to continue. So.
Okay. Well, it kicks off like this because, as you mentioned, he's still a boy, the super prophet. But it begins in chapter 3, and he's still a boy. It says, "Now the boy Samuel ministered to Yehovah before Eli, and the word of Yehovah was rare in those days, and there it was." And there was no widespread revelation. And it came to pass at that time, while Eli was lying down in his place, when his eyes began to grow dim so that he could not see, and before the lamp of God went out in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark was, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down, the Yehovah called Samuel.
Is that literally what's written in your English?
That's what I've got. It says, in the tabernacle of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and while Samuel was lying down, that Yehovah called Samuel.
Okay, so your text has been corrected. Your text has been adjusted to something because there's a few issues here. So first of all, it says here that his eyes have become dim, and then there's a parallel here that explains what does it mean his eyes have become dim? He cannot see anymore. So this is a parallel. There's mm-hmm. a small thing we have here. But actually it says in Hebrew, and the candle of God has not diminished yet. And Samuel is laying down in the Heichal, the big house. Heichal is the big house, or the temple of God, which the temple of the Lord, which the ark of God is there. And when you read this in Hebrew, it sounds as if he's actually resting inside the tabernacle itself.
Mm.
Verse itself is a lot very confusing. So a lot of this is considered one of the difficult verses anywhere in the Bible, and there are different opinions exactly what it means, but what's very, very interesting, first of all, notice the fact that both, there's actually a parallels in between verse 2 and verse 3, and what's going on here, it was at that time, or that day, so we're actually talking about a specific day, there's a date, doesn't give us the date, but there's a specific date that something big happens, and this big thing is revelation, suddenly there's prophecy. There was almost no prophets, barely any prophets. There's this man of God that shows up before Eli. We don't even know if it's a human being.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an interesting parallel here. Now, this is a special day. This is when Samuel becomes a prophet. This is where he starts gaining his name. But what's interesting, if you look, there's parallels here. So they're both laying down. It uses the same verb, shochev, which is to lay down. Now, his eyes are going dim, but in verse 3, the candle of God has not has not diminished yet. Well, the lamp of God has not diminished yet. So first of all, this is called a chiastic parallel, where it's in an X. If you take both halves of each verse and you put them in sequence, part one of verse one will be parallel to part four, or second half of verse. So it's taking 1, 2, 3, 4. Part one will parallel to part four. Part two is parallel to part three. So it's an X, a xi, chiastic. Okay? That's a, something it's used a lot in the Bible. Mm-hmm. So they're parallel to one another. Now, what does it mean the candle hasn't diminished yet? Some people say it's the Western candle of the menorah. Probably is, because the candle is burns. They adjust it so it burns very late into the night. So it says this is it hasn't burned out yet. So this is early on. This is not they're not dreaming. This is they're still kind of half awake. They haven't fallen asleep yet. And there's a comma. There's a stop. So the candle hasn't dimmed yet. And Samuel's laying down. But then we have a kind of a disjunctive section, a disjunctive verset here, because he's laying down in the tabernacle in the actual where the ark actually literally is. So when I went to Shiloh some time back, so there's a video of it and everything. I just have to edit the video. I'm planning on putting it up on the YouTube channel that I've created for the videos, which I forgot to mention. So I went to Shiloh and I took a video then. I have pictures and everything, and Keith was with me, or I was with him, depends how you look at it. And we're working on the Time Will Tell project. There, I put it in there again. Anyhow, so what's interesting is actually there's two structures there. There's two platforms and two structures. So they probably treated the whole campus there, the whole thing there, as altogether being the house of God. So it wasn't that he was laying down literally inside the tabernacle. He was probably in the complex of the place which they called the house of God. So they had probably their own dorm there or somewhere to sleep in, Eli and his sons, and also for Samuel, because Samuel was basically, you have to imagine Samuel as this little kid or young man that does different things for the high priest. So he's serving God. It says here he's serving God, he's serving the Lord before Eli. So his service to God is actually helping out this old man. So he probably helped him get up. Stuff that I would say that probably his sons had to do, were supposed to do, and they didn't, which gives us another insight to who they really were. But he probably walked with him, and he was helping him out, and he served him, and carried things for him, and fetch me my stick, stuff like that. That's probably what he was doing. So he had to sleep not too far away from Eli. They were probably sleeping in this thing, but this entire complex was probably called the House of God. And that might explain what's going on here. So this is a slightly disjunctive verse in the Hebrew, but it's pointing out the ark. And I think the ark here is a very, very important element, because when you look at the different cases where prophets receive their receive the first prophecy, become the anointed to become prophets, there's always cherubs there and everything, which means he's in the proximity of the ark. He's in the proximity of the cherubs, of the kuvim. He's near the place of revelation of God. So he doesn't need that super duper revelation. He has it physically in front of him. He has the ark in front of him. And that's personally why I think it's the ark is mentioned here. Why is it emphasized? Because he's near the place of revelation. He's near the place where Moses received the word of God. So again, a parallel to Moses. He's close to it. So maybe even the sound resonated from the ark itself. I don't know.
But well, so that's what I was. I'm just wondering about that now, because the way that you're painting the picture, and I'm thinking, I wonder if the ark does resonate, if the sound does resonate from the ark. But it's interesting because Yehovah calls Samuel, and he immediately acknowledges that he's been called, and he says, "Here I am." And so he runs off to Eli. And so you think, well, does Yehovah sound like Eli, or is it really? It's probably more the case that there's not going to be anyone else in the. It's just common sense that he would run to Eli, and he says, "Here I am, for you called me." And he said, "I didn't call you. Go and lie down." And he went and lay down. And then Yehovah called yet again, Samuel. Do you reckon he was having a chuckle? I mean,
I think you have to remember something. First of all, he's a child, 6 years old, 7 years old, 10 years old. We don't know how old he was here. And, he's used to Eli calling him in the middle of the night. He's almost blind, and he needs a pitcher of water. He wants to drink. He needs to get up, whatever it is. You know, there's something going on. And, you know, he's used to, if there's a voice in the night, it's usually Eli. Now, you know, maybe the voice of God came out like the voice of Eli, so it's something he recognizes. You know, you try to comfort a child with something he recognizes. Or that it was a whisper. Mm-hmm. And Samuel. And he couldn't make the difference if it's Eli's voice or not. But, he shows how loyal he is. He just gets up and runs. And you see how the language goes. And it says here, it uses a very, very short, there's a thing called a meta, which is a speed of how many words are in. And if there's more words, it slows down. If there's less words, it speeds up. And it's very fast. He says, Hineni, here I am. And the next thing is he runs. It says, Vayarotz el Eli. He runs to Eli. He's like, anything Eli needs to me is a service of God. He jumps out of bed and he speeds on, wiping his eyes, trying to wake up, but he's running towards Eli. And Eli says to him, no, I didn't call you. Okay, go back to bed. So it says, he goes and goes back to bed. It's all very, very fast. There's less words here. He uses very, very short verbs. Goes back to bed. He says, go back to bed. Okay, I'm going back to bed. He goes back to bed and he lays down.
So you're right. But you're right. There's a sense of urgency in the way that it is written that he gets up and he's very quick about it. And verse 7 says, now Samuel did not yet know that Yehovah. Oh, no, sorry. It says, now Samuel did not yet know Yehovah, nor was the word of Yehovah yet established to him. What does that mean to you?
So there's two ways of dealing with this. It can say that we have to look at these. First of all, it uses the same word, terem, which means not yet. And it's used in different ways. I'm not going to go into that. It's no point. But it says, Samuel did not know yet the Lord. Now, what does it mean, no? So there's two ways of reading this. You can read it the way you read it. He doesn't know who God is, which I doubt because he's living in the temple. So he has some kind of an idea. But you can read it the way you read it. Nor does he, so the vav here, veterem migale, the vav here is used as nor XYZ. Some people actually read this as the second half being an explanation of the first half. What does it mean he doesn't know? It doesn't mean that he doesn't know God at all. It's he has not received prophecy yet. This is the first time.
So instead of, perhaps it reads, now Samuel did not yet know the Lord because, instead of nor, because exactly. The word of the Lord was not yet revealed to him. That's potentially a way to read it.
Is the second half of the verse a circumstantial clause, or is it just another piece? Is explanation of number one a result of number one, either circumstantial or result clause? They're very similar. So for some reason, the English books try to divide sentences up into more and more and more pieces. In Hebrew, it's kind of funny. I look at English books that explain biblical Hebrew, and they try to elaborate more than what we do when you read a Hebrew book. So in other words, I have a Hebrew book that explains biblical Hebrew. It's like 100 and something pages, and I have a biblical Hebrew book in English, which is hundreds of pages long. It's kind of funny.
No, that makes sense.
These types of verses are not the end of the world. There are places where it's a bit more important to actually know what the verses are saying and how each half corresponds to one another. For example, in poetic language, the corresponding particles in verses to one another is a bit more critical. But all the relationship between verses is a bit more critical. But here, it's a storyline. So it's either this or either that, and both are logical, so we're going to let both of them go. Because it doesn't really change much of the meaning. But I just have these doubts. I have a doubt that because, you know, it doesn't mean he doesn't know God. I mean, he's, you know, he might be a child, but he's not an idiot. He's actually a pretty smart one. He sings out very, very quickly. To know something, again, the issue of to know is a slightly more complex than just saying the issue of knowledge. It's a recognition, maybe. Some places it has a meaning of a slightly covenant issue as well. Slightly more complex than that. To know someone. For example, it says that when God knows someone, it's also an issue of acting upon that knowledge. Knowing it with God is not just You know, he has knowledge. It's the issue of recognition and acting upon that recognition. So it could be that what it means he doesn't know God is that he's not acted upon this knowledge of God. He just knows there's God and he understands the basic principles of what that there is God, but he hasn't acted upon it. And the other half is that he hasn't received revelation, there hasn't been any prophecy yet. That'd be another way of reading it.
Sure. Sure. And so Yehovah called Samuel again the third time. So he rose, went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you did call me." And then Eli perceived, he goes, I understand now. I see what's going on. And he says, and he perceived that Yehovah had called the boy. Therefore, Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down and it shall be. If he calls you again, that you must say, 'Speak, Yehovah, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went down and lay in his place. Now Yehovah came and stood. Now Yoel, it says, now I want to know what it says in Hebrew. Now Yehovah came and stood and called as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." Do you have "came and stood"?
So first of all, just notice the fact that there's more words here. So now he's like, it's like, "I'm confused." So he walks slowly back home. So he's back to his bed. He's kind of like, "Okay, what's going on here? I don't get this." So there's more words. As I mentioned, there's less words now. There's more words because he's walking back and he's kind of confused. Maybe slightly like, "You know, I'm too tired for this. Leave me alone." So he just marches back home, back to his bed. So what's interesting here, he uses "vayityatzav," "vayka kefam befam." So "vayityatzav" is to stand, to present oneself. So it could be that the word "yitiyatzev" here is revealed himself. You know, now he's being very, very clear. In the beginning, it was like, "Samuel, Samuel," you know, "Shmuel, Shmuel." And he was being obscure about it. And now it could be the "vayityatzev." Remember that, you know, a physical being stood up and walked towards him, or he saw an image. Some people say he might have seen some kind of an image. But on the other hand, it could be that there's a presence, he felt a presence, or it could be that now that he's quote-unquote as if standing before him, now he's being very clear about who he is and what he wants from him. So he doesn't have to necessarily just as, you know, disconnected from the rest of it. What does it mean he showed up before him? Actually, it doesn't mean he showed up. He made it clear. He revealed himself. But it doesn't use the word "reveal," but he stands in front of him, which probably means he revealed himself, and now he fully understands what's going on. Now he's received a full, clear, "Okay, now I know. I feel something. There's something here," and he knows clearly that it's gone. Before that, it was just a voice. Now there's a presence. And you have it with Daniel. When Daniel, when there's the presence of God, even other people were able to feel it. He was on a turning, he says that "Vehodine pacharai lemashchit," his stomach turned on him and everything. But the other people around him also felt something. So this might be what it means. Now, again, the discussion, physical, non-physical, does God appear in a physical form? I mean, that's a long discussion that we can have some other time.
Well, I suppose the other option is that perhaps it was an angel on behalf of Yehovah, an angel who's speaking on behalf of Yehovah. May have just decided, "Look, let's just be a little bit more direct. I'll just stand here and Samuel, Samuel." But in any case, there's another discrepancy here that I want to ask you about. And maybe this is just a minor thing, but when Eli says to Samuel, "Hey, if he calls you again, say, 'Speak, Yehovah, for your servant hears.'" But in this case, Yehovah came and stood and called as other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel answered, "Speak, your servant hears." The name is not there. What do the sages say about that? Is there anything deeper into that, or is he just paraphrasing what Eli has told him?
So I've never found, I mean, I don't remember anyone explains why he does. I mean, I can open up a book here very, very quickly. What is it? I looked in several things when I was preparing this. I didn't see anyone explain why, but let's see if this book maybe says.
Because I wonder if Samuel initially wasn't 100% sold that, Eli perceived, it doesn't say that Samuel perceived, but Eli perceived that the God was speaking to the boy. Perhaps Samuel himself wasn't so convinced and thought maybe someone's, you know, pulling his leg, so to speak. And so he says, "Speak, for your servant hears," but he doesn't include the name. And I find that curious.
I'm looking at and looking now, and I'm trying to think backwards as well. And that's more or less what everyone says. He wasn't convinced. It was like someone was pulling a prank on me or something. He wasn't. You look at this. So he walks back. I mean, you have to read things together. So he walks back slowly to bed. He's maybe thinking, maybe he's thinking to himself, well, maybe the old man is here. He's trying to lose it. He's calling out to me, but he then tells me it's not him. So he might be kind of suspicious. Notice the fact that he walks back slowly. He doesn't run back anymore. He's like, he's confused. What is going on here? Why am I hearing this voice? He's the only person here, but he claims it's not him. So he was very, very suspicious. And he didn't want to say, maybe he didn't want to say the name of God because he knew the implications of turning around and saying, are you God? Is it you? He might have been slightly concerned also not using the name of God for no reason. But there's no proof of what I just said. It might be, it might not be.
Verse 11, then Jehovah said to Samuel, behold, I will do something in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. Tingle?
So in Hebrew it's titzalna. And titzana is from the word tzilzul. So it's either tingle or ring. Their ears will ring, and maybe even from the root of tzalal, which is to fold. When a person tries to cut out something terrible, they cover their ears, they fold their ears down. It could be, some people say it's from the root of tzlil. Some people say it's from the word of tzalal. So tzlil is a sound, tingle, or ring. But also after maybe these things are together, the ears will ring, so the people will fold their ears down with their hands to cover from the terrible information that's about to happen. Mm-hmm. By the way, the word hine, by the way, it's a classic thing. Everyone translates it as being behold, but sometimes hine doesn't certainly mean behold. Sometimes it's something is about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It doesn't have to always be declarative. Something's going to be like, something's going to happen.
Something certainly is about to happen. We're going to read about that next week in chapter 4 and 5, and it reveals...
If we succeed to read more than one chapter at a time.
At a time. In that day, Jehovah continues, in that day I will perform against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from the beginning to the end, for I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them. There it is. His sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them.
By the way, in this section, the words house of or his house appear four times. It's emphasized. So it appears as his house, the house of Eli. It's emphasized because the point is that what his children did was the problem. But because he's their father, he's responsible for what they did. So it's interesting. They're adults, but as their father, he still has responsibility over them.
He has a responsibility. I was about to say, he has a responsibility, and his responsibility obviously was, at least while they were young enough, he should have restrained them.
But even when they're older, I mean, we're talking at this point, they're adults. I mean, you don't serve in the temple before you're at least 20 years old, if not 25. So they're not children. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned last week, they're probably somewhere in their 60s because he's 98. They might be in their 60s or even 70s. They're not children. They might be grandparents by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And even at that age, he's still responsible for them. You have to remember, the average age, if you look, for example, the Book of Kings, a lot of the kings had children by the age of 14, 15. Sure. Now, if he's 98 years old and say he had his first son when he was 14 years old, his son is, 84?
Pretty old.
Pretty old, and he's still responsible for them. Yeah, so it's a difference in culture. In the ancient world, and it's still like that in the Arab culture, westernized culture changed everything, but in traditional cultures of the East, the grandfather was like a grand representative of the family. Feuds will be taken to him. He decides a lot of things.
He's an elder and judge of the tribe, right?
Exactly. He's an elder and judge of the family. Put aside the issue of the tribe, he's an elder and judge of the family. Mm. Grandparents were, in the Arab culture, for example, which is very similar to what was done thousands of years ago, the grandparents, the entire family lived together in the same house. The grandparents have their own room or section of the house, and they're responsible. I mean, I've seen cases of Arab grandfathers or parents hitting their 30, 40-year-old son. Your father's like in his 60s. He picks up a stick and smacks the son over his back. And he's allowed to do that. Now, in the Jewish culture, we say not to do that because if you hurt your son and he might overreact and throw something and might kill you or hurt you as a parent, then you're kind of responsible for what just happened because you caused him to lose his temper and
But this is my point, that if he had a handle on his children when they were younger, perhaps they wouldn't be so restrained. And as the Bible refers to them in, I think it's chapter 2, early in chapter 2, that they were, Eli's sons were men of Belial, unrestrained.
So that's also a possibility that really the story began when he was in his 40s and his children were only in their 20s. And perhaps. We have here that he's 98 years old. This is like later on, years and years later. Mm. But the problem is that the association with Samuel, Samuel's mentioned in the storyline as well, but it could be that Samuel's not really in the story yet, but this is 50 years ago when Eli was younger and his children were younger, and you might be right. I mean, again, there's two ways of reading this. That Samuel's not there yet, but he's brought in as a comparison to what his children were doing, and the storyline here was going on for years and years and years. I mean, again, if we say this happened now, then, you know, where's the point? Where's the time to repent? But then, you know, we have to remember God waits to see what happens. And it might be that the story we had, and you have a very good point here, it might be the story we had here in chapter 2, verses 11 verse 17 was going on for years and years and years and years, and this is why they're being so severely punished. It wasn't just, you know, they did it once or they did it for a couple of years. It's been going on for 3-4 years. This might have been going on for decades.
And that's the way that I read it. That's the sense that I get anyhow, because it begins by telling us that they are men without yoke. They're men, unrestrained men. And it seems like it has gone on for a time and that he has allowed to have it by his passivity, Eli. And so here it is, and the judgment is declared on him. In verse 14, therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for, Yoel, shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever.
Because this actually works very well with the Torah, because in Numbers it mentions that if someone does a willful sin, and this is willful, there wasn't a mistake. They knew very well what they were doing. There's no way of atoning for it. There's no atonement. The only atonement probably is, you know, dying. And this is what happens, bring the judgment, destruction of the house of Eli, and that's the only way they atone for it.
That says a lot. I mean, obviously his sons were the ones who were actively going out and acting presumptuously against the law of Jehovah. But Eli was passively condoning what they were doing. Though he said in his speech, you must not do these kind of things, he was not active against what they were doing. Therefore, he was seen to be passively condoning it. And that seems to be, judging by these verses, an equally terrible sin. Would you agree?
Yeah, it is. But if you remember, he doesn't die a violent death. He dies differently. So the judgment on him is a bit, it's not as harsh, but this is still very, very harsh. I mean, he's been told, you're going to be removed from the priesthood. Your family is going to be destroyed. There's no way of atoning for this sin for your house. It's like really pretty
really drastic. Serious stuff.
Yeah, it's very drastic. It's horrible.
And just reminded everyone, this is what Yehovah is laying on Samuel, the boy. He's giving this information to the boy. And so Samuel lay down until morning and opened the doors of the house of Yehovah. And Samuel was afraid, and wouldn't you be, Yoel? Samuel was afraid to tell Eli the vision. And then Eli called Samuel and said to Samuel, he said, Samuel, my son. He said, here I am. And he said to him, quick, what is it, the word that Yehovah spoke to you? Please do not hide it from me. God do so to you, and even more, if you hide anything from me of all the things that he said to you. And so Samuel was like, well.
First of all, it's a form of oath. This is a shortened form of oath. Ko yaseh lecha Elohim v'cho yosif. One of the ways of creating an oath is what's in a case of what's called ellipsis, where you don't mention what the exact words of the oath are, but you allude to it by saying God may God do XYZ, but you don't mention the XYZ. You just say may God do to you as he's done, and you don't really mention beyond that, but you allude to it. And there's also, again, an interesting structure. He uses the same, you know, there's different words he uses here, which he repeats several times. At least in the Hebrew you see it. And he's trying to, you know, first of all, he turns around to him and he says, He turns to me and says, you know, Samuel, my son. Very compelling, you know, my son, my beloved one, being very nice to him. And he says to him, what did God say to him? And but he now you start seeing the pressure, because, you know, he calls him over and he looks at him and he realizes he's worried about something. So he knows there's a reason to be concerned. He mentions, he says, he was afraid to tell him, so interesting, he uses the word mar'eh, which is a vision, which kind of, we can send that back to the issue of standing before him. He might have actually seen something. So that actually works with what we have vayitiyatzav in verse 10. So actually, he probably did see some kind of a vision. Okay, so now we realize something. In the beginning, we didn't notice it. Now we have. Okay, so I admit that I made a mistake here, and probably he did see something. When it says vayitiyatzav, he actually saw something. Was it God himself, or was it an angel, or some kind of image? We don't know. But
surely it was an angel. I mean, from what we know from the story of Moses, I don't know that Yehovah would have appeared before him and spoken to him, but I would be more inclined to hazard a guess that it would have been an angel speaking on in the authority of Yehovah.
Okay, well, we'll go with that. But he says he was afraid to tell him, and now, you know, he hasn't seen him yet. He just wakes up and he's concerned, and you can see it on his face. Now, a child has, it's a bit more difficult for a child to hide what's going through his mind. You know, is he worried? Is he afraid? What's going on?
Oh, look, you know what I mean. You got four sons. You got four little Prince Halevis. And, you know, when there's something that they don't want dad to find out, they wear it on their face. And you go, what are you doing? What have you been doing? What are you thinking?
Exactly. So he calls him over and he sees his face. And he goes, uh-oh. An uh-oh moment. And who has the uh-oh? Is it Keith that has an uh-oh moment or something?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's Keith. I mean, the uh-oh moments. So he has an uh-oh moment. And he's looking at him, and he sees his facial expression, and he goes, okay, something's going on. So now he's really worried. So, you know, he notices that he's afraid to say anything, because if he was able to tell him, he would immediately run to him in the middle of the night, or even before he opens the doors, he would run to Eli and tell him, but he doesn't. So Eli kind of realizes he has to squeeze it out of him. So he threatens him. In the beginning, he goes, like, he's really nice to him. He calls him over. Would you please come over and everything? Maybe even with a smile. And when he's actually close to him, he might, you know, maybe in grabbing distance. And he goes, okay, now you tell me what he told you, because if you don't, I swear to God.
There's going to be trouble.
may happen to you as well. And he says, I said swear to God deliberately. I swear to God it will happen to you.
Because that's basically what he's saying, yeah.
That's basically what he's saying.
Absolutely. And so it leaves Samuel.
By the way, saying there's a range, something people should know. When people say, when some people use the phrase, I swear to God, they should be very, very careful when they say that. Be very, very careful when you say that. Now, obviously, I think that the text in Torah actually says, you know, only if someone swears in the name of Yud Hei Vav Hei.
But still.
Alluding to the name or alluding to who you mean is also a form of oath. Because, for example, like he says here, he doesn't say the name of God. He says Elohim, which just means God. So he's when you say that, even saying I swear to God or may God do X, Y, you're still actually invoking something. And you have to be very, very careful when you do that.
Very good advice. And so he leaves Samuel no choice, but he's got to tell him. So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, this is the response from Eli. It says, it is Yehovah. Let him do what seems good to him. And what are you going to say? I mean,
what can you do? It is what it is. He's realized his mistake. This is the second witness for him, because he had the man of God come up to him. Now, Samuel's saying the same thing. He realized, okay, it's real. It's true. What can I do? I made a mistake, you know, and this is a certain level of repentance.
And so this is really revisiting on the doom and gloom of the story of Eli's sons, as we were doing last week. But after, you know, each time it does that, as you keep pointing out, there's the light at the end of the tunnel. There's the ray of sunshine, and it brings it back to us in verse 19. It says, so Samuel grew, and Yehovah was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, knew that Samuel had been established as a prophet of Yehovah. Then Yehovah appeared again in Shiloh, for Yehovah revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of Yehovah, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now, Yehovah appeared again in Shiloh for Yehovah revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of Yehovah. But we don't actually have those specific details, do we?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But the center, it's the Shiloh is the center. Now, what's very, very interesting here as well is first of all, we don't really have any details regarding when exactly things were happening. I mean, I used the 98-year-old point of reference, but first of all, we don't even know. I mean, this is for years, and he might be in his 20s, 30s when Shiloh was destroyed, which means Eli might have been in his 70s when he was told by Samuel. I was just using 98 as a point of reference, and now the penny's dropping that I missed out on something where the 98 is a reference when Shiloh is destroyed. And I kept on keeping the 98 in my head. Actually, probably is a mistake. So probably what's going on here was probably someone in his 70s, maybe even in his 60s, and but he's getting old, which raises a lot of questions. How did he continue being the high priest if he can't see?
Because he had Samuel, right? He had Samuel to help him out.
Yeah, but for example, when he does the service of Yom HaKippur, he does everything by himself. And there's points where no one's allowed to be in the tabernacle. True. How does he know where he's sprinkling the blood? How does he know where he's pouring things? You know, how does he know what he's doing? How does he know where he's butchering the animal correctly? You know, he's throwing the fat onto the fire. He doesn't see the fire. How does he know where to throw it? So you know, I was using 98 as a reference point. I probably was wrong about that. But again, the ages here is not really that important. But also you said he appeared again. It doesn't use the word again in the Hebrew. It says, Vayosef Adonai lehera'o b'shiloh. So actually, Vayosef means either another time or continuously. He kept on appearing before Samuel in Shiloh.
Ah, so the drought of revelation, the drought of prophecy was over. And he basically saying he was with Samuel in Shiloh basically from that point on is the idea that you get from it.
Yeah, so he was probably living in Shiloh and probably living in the area of the tabernacle. And they were making sure, you know, God continuously appeared to him. But at one point, he becomes the leader of the people, so he has to leave the tabernacle and go around the land. But for a very, very long time, people knew, okay, we go to Shiloh to receive the word of God through his prophet Samuel. Mm-hmm. What's also very interesting is chapter 4 is actually the first verse, is actually what the last thing you read, but we read only half of it. And in the Hebrew Bible, it's cut. There's like there's a space in between the first half and the second half, which also indicates the whole thing of the chapter division being a bit problematic, and sometimes even verse division being a bit problematic. There are certain cases it was done deliberately, certain cases it was done by mistake. But also what's interesting is it also says here in verse 20, Ki ne'eman Shmuel en avila Adonai, ne'eman is the same word used about Moses. It says the Ki b'chol beiti ne'emanhu, for he is loyal in my entire house. He is loyal, meaning I can trust him. So he uses the same words about Samuel, which is very, very interesting.
Indeed. And you're quite right. It is we just finished on the first sentence of chapter 4, and the word of Shmuel Samuel came to all Israel. After that, we're back in the doom and gloom of the brought on by the sons of Eli, Pinchas, Hophni and Hophni.
By the way, I actually looked into that. We mentioned last time that Hophni and Pinchas are names that probably, at least Pinchas, because there was Pinchas ben Elazar, Pinchas the son of Elazar, who was the grandson of Aaron. So these might have been names that went through the family. But I was looking up the name of Pinchas specifically, and also probably Hophni. These are Egyptian names, which is a very interesting thing. So, for example, this was brought up in a book. I was going through a few things. I mentioned the fact that there are Egyptian names used in the Bible in different places, which show a very, very strong connection to Egypt. And I was looking, this was a book about ancient Israel, I'm still reading, and the writer points out that, you know, he's trying to come from this writer comes from a perspective of a scholar, but one that doesn't accept everything that the high criticism and everything try to pull. He basically says, well, there's a few elements which are very, very important to notice. For example, the usage of Egyptian names, as he specifically mentions, Aharon and Aaron and Pinchas and Hophni. These are Egyptian names, and they're not. And the, if the Israelites were Canaanites, you would find pure Canaanite names. That's at least his claim. But we do have to remember that Egypt did control the land of Canaan, and then the land of Israel for a while. But it's interesting that these are Egyptian names, and they show up in a culture that's presumably Canaanite. Mm-hmm. So, anyhow.
Yeah, very valid. And thanks for bringing that. So that is it, my friends. Thank you, Yoel Ben Shloman. I should just remind everybody, Hebrew in Israel. We are expecting a website very soon, and we'll keep listeners up to date when that happens. But until then, please get on Facebook and like Hebrew in Israel. You can find it there and see if we can tip Yoel over the 1,000 mark this week. And but until next week, dear listeners, we're going to be doing chapter 4 and 5 then. Be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom, Kodesh.